Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday morning. Welcome to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up this morning, what a healthcare merger could mean for Arizona Medicaid patients.
And the story of Ken Patrick, a national park ranger for whom a trail is named at the Grand Canyon.
But first, in 2018, Phoenix police were involved in 44 shootings that took 22 lives. The number made Phoenix the department with the most officer-involved shootings in the nation that year. But that changed dramatically in 2019. Last year, Phoenix logged 15 officer-involved shootings, the fewest the department has seen in the last decade, according to the Arizona Republic. So what's changed? After the city's grim record-setting year in 2018, Phoenix sought an outside opinion. The nonpartisan National Police Foundation came up with 9 recommendations to change the department's course, and Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams committed to following them.
Chief Williams declined an invitation from the show to talk about what has been working for her officers. But joining us now is one of the co-authors of the National Police Foundation study on the Phoenix Police Department. Justin Nix is a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Justin, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with a quick review, Cammy. What were the recommendations to the department following the 2018 numbers, and which of those were adopted?
So the number one recommendation that we made was for officers to be required to document when they point their guns at citizens, even if they don't actually pull the trigger. And that was based on research that has shown that agencies that do that have, on average, a lower rate of officer-involved shootings, and it doesn't decrease officer safety to require them to do that. And to my knowledge, that policy was implemented circa August of last year. We made several recommendations about improving data collection so that reports like the one we wrote could be a little more rigorously conducted. Recommendations about improving training, being transparent with data with the public, community engagement, increasing the use of proactive policing units. We recommended that they do a staffing study and to take a look at some of their records management systems. And lastly, perhaps most importantly, to consider alternatives to how officers respond to mentally ill persons.
Is it possible to make the leap from the department implementing some or all of those recommendations to what we saw in terms of the decrease in the number of officer-involved shootings last year?
I don't think so. I think it's good that the agency has taken steps towards implementing these policies, but short of a rigorous random control trial where we could isolate, you know, the introduction of these new policy changes and look at data before and after those were rolled out, you can't really say with any confidence that that's what's caused the number to go down. Because if you go back to 2009, which is as far back as we went with the report, you know, there were 4 years on record where the agency had 18 or fewer shootings. So 15's right in that ballpark. And so the number of officer-involved shootings year to year is going to bounce around. And 2018 was a year where it bounced relatively high, higher than it had been. And so, frankly, I'm not that surprised that the number is down in 2019 relative to that high year.
Well, how much does that bounce happen? I mean, you mentioned that you're not surprised that it's down after 2018, but is it typical or atypical to have that big of a jump year to year?
No, I mean, yeah. So from 2017 to 2018, the number doubled. And so that was part of what prompted Chief Williams to ask us to come in and look for some answers, because it was pretty unprecedented. And some things that we noticed was that, you know, their numbers were down in terms of their sworn capacity as a result of a hiring freeze that had taken place several years prior. And they still haven't sort of refilled those positions that they didn't hire to. And then the number of gun assaults on officers doubled year over year. So, frankly, policing in Phoenix, Arizona, for the last couple years, it's been a pretty volatile situation. And so 2018 ends up being a rough year in terms of the number of officer-involved shootings. But here it is back down. And so the 10-year average that we saw was roughly 22, 23 per year. And so for it to be below even that 10-year average is encouraging.
Well, Justin, now that the numbers are down in Phoenix, at least for last year and over the average, isn't standing out quite as much. How does it compare to the rest of the country? I mean, are there other cities that Phoenix is more in line with now?
It's tough to compare. I think the natural inclination is to look at other cities of similar size. But there's so much more context that you have to think about in terms of what's the violent crime rate look like, what's the number of officers, like the officer to citizen ratio. I know a lot's always made out of New York with their low rate, given that it's the most populous city in the country. You know, but the fact is they have a huge department, and so they have a lot more officers per citizens out in the community. And that factors into how these volatile incidents might play out, right? So I haven't looked at the numbers for last year or what's going on this year. I expect that Phoenix would be similarly placed, somewhere among the top 10 or so in terms of rates. But that on its own, I don't think is a measure of, you know, how well or how poorly they're performing in that regard, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You just have to think of so many things more than how many citizens are out there and how much crime's going on.
All right. That is Justin Nix, a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Justin, thank you.
Thank you.
The Phoenix City Council is considering creating a citizen review board to oversee the city's police department. The idea has been gaining steam since a series of incidents involving use of force and racist social media posts put the department in the spotlight. The idea is a controversial one, and with me to talk through how city and police leaders, as well as residents, may be thinking about this is William Terrell. He's a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice here at ASU. He's also an associate dean in the Watts College of Public Service and Community Solutions. And William, what in your mind is the best way for a city to have this kind of conversation? And how should the board be set up if that community decides to go that way?
Well, it's obviously a complex issue, and cities have struggled with it for many years, decades, in fact. And so there's no clear-cut path. Cities tend to take various routes in terms of, do they want a civilian review board? And if so, what would that look like? And there's lots of different models out there. So I think having a discussion on the front end with the community, with leaders in a city, within the police department, is the right way to go to see what the comfort zone is, as opposed to we're going to go with a civilian review board and it's going to look like X or Y.
Is there evidence that once a city implements a citizens review board, or for those cities that have had them, that the relationship between the police department and the community is appreciably better than it was without that board?
It's really mixed. There's really no consistency across. There's a degree of distrust on both sides in most cities, which is what often drives, right, the discussion of should we have a citizen review board. And so much of the discussion or much of the debate comes down to, can someone outside a police department, someone that's not a police officer, can they technically and sufficiently and objectively investigate a complaint? And police departments will often make the arguments it's because policing, in terms of tactics and procedures, it's not clear to a civilian what's appropriate use of force, for instance.
So do police departments generally oppose citizens review boards? Like, have there been instances in cities where the police have been on board, the officers, the rank and file, the unions have been on board with either the creation of this kind of board or with its existence?
I'd say most cities, you know, if you look across the country, most cities are decently comfortable, I think, with the idea. I think where the debate or maybe a little of the consternation comes into play is what it's going to look like. And that usually revolves around who's going to do the investigation. And so within the different models out there, I think the police in many cities will oppose where the citizens solely are going to do an investigation of a complaint, for instance, without any police internal affairs support of that. If the proposed model is, look, we have civilian review, they can be part of the investigation or at least do a check and balance on the back end, then departments are generally comfortable with that.
It seems like it's such a fine line to walk because, as you just described, the police departments want to be careful that civilians, you know, non-officers, non-police, don't have the sole discretion to investigate. While on the other hand, I would imagine a lot of community groups are nervous about police officers sort of seizing control of these boards and, in their minds, maybe whitewashing incidents of use of force and officers not necessarily being punished when maybe they deserve to be.
Yeah, you've hit it spot on, I think. I think the issue often comes down to, is the complaint process a legitimate process? Does the community feel that whatever that internal investigation process is, or if it's internal affairs within the department, or if the civilians are going to be involved, is it fair? Is it legitimate process? Or is it simply, you know, going through the motions, what's often referred to as empty formalism, where there appears to be a process in place, it looks like legitimate, but if you look behind the curtains, what you find is that there's really not much legitimacy to the process. And there's where the rub is. And I think there's lots of room for compromise here. And I think a lot of cities have found that. And that's why most cities have some form of civilian review now.
Based on the recent past of the Phoenix Police Department and the community here within the city, do you get the sense that there is compromise to be had here as well?
I do. I know from the outside, it can look like, wow, this could be a difficult process to move down. But it's really no different than you know, the 100-plus cities across the country that now have civilian review boards. There's usually, if you trace the history, you'll see some kind of process that you see in Phoenix right now where, boy, we're not sure if we want to have this. Is it going to be a legitimate process? I do think there's compromise. It's just, it's a process. My fear when jurisdictions start talking about civilian review boards is that, you know, it's like a magic wand that all of a sudden everything's better, that the police are always happy, the citizens are always happy. And that's really not the experience with civilian review boards. You know, it's not this perfect implementation process.
You mentioned that, you know, just having a citizens review board does not make the police always happy and the citizens of a city always happy. What is a realistic outcome that would be positive, I guess? Like, what's the best case scenario for a city like Phoenix setting up a citizens review board?
I think one of the big positives that can come out of it is an educational component. It is, if it plays out where there's police officers involved, there's citizens involved, there can be an education component where the police can see the community's perspective. Oh, I can see why you may be upset with this. However, this is in proper policy and procedure. Let me explain why. And so both guys can say, yes, I can see how that looks to the untrained eye of civilian, why that looks like improper force. And the citizen can see and hear from the police why that was proper force or why that's proper tactics and procedures. So I think that educational component is a big part of it. And that's often a big positive that comes out of it. A second component, which I'll mention, and some of the research I did back in 2015, we looked at 8 cities across the country, and we found that the cities that had some kind of civilian review component to it, that those cities had a higher sustained complaint rate, meaning that the board and the internal affairs was agreeing that there was some kind of deviation of the policy. And so I think that's a positive outcome. The citizens say, look, we have a part in this, and this is leading to more sustained complaints and legitimacy of the institution.
All right, that's William Terrell. He's a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. He's also Associate Dean in the Watts College of Public Service and Community Solutions. William, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has been a target of conservatives for generations. They've labeled it too big, too busy, and too liberal. But the California-based circuit, which also includes Arizona, has seen a shift during the Trump administration, as a number of openings on the panel have been filled by more conservative Trump appointees. Susanna Luthi of Politico recently wrote a story about that and is with me to talk about it. Susanna, how much of an impact has President Trump had on the 9th Circuit in those 3 years in the White House?
One of the idiosyncrasies of the 9th Circuit is because it's so big, it's 29 judges. When any party to a case asks for a full review of the court, that panel actually is only 11 judges who are picked totally random. So now that the court is almost evenly split with Republican and Democratic appointees, Democrats still have a three-judge majority, it's more and more likely to have a bench that's majority Republican appointees. And the other kind of big point that liberals made to me repeatedly is that, you know, these judges, six of these appointments actually were not approved by home state senators because Congress got rid of the blue, what's called the blue slip tradition that lets the home state senators kind of have final say in who gets nominated and appointed to the courts. So that's allowed President Trump to nominate far more conservative judges, and that's kind of where the major concerns lie with liberals.
And the Ninth Circuit is taking up a lot of, let's say, important and in some cases emotional topics. What are some of those? Remind folks of what some of those major things are.
Well, a very big one is the Title X lawsuit. Title X is a family planning program that's been in place since the Nixon administration. There's just been ongoing litigation over a Trump administration rule that basically bars Planned Parenthood from participating in the program. Planned Parenthood has been kind of a fixture in that program for years, and President Reagan also tried to kind of kick them out of the program, only to be overturned by the Supreme Court. That case is now two district judges within states that are in the Ninth Circuit jurisdiction blocked that rule from taking effect. It's now under review in the Ninth Circuit, and it's currently being weighed by a panel of judges that is majority conservative and includes some Trump nominees.
We've seen so much when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court as far as appointments, not that they weren't politicized before, but even more so it seems now. Should we expect to see more fights, frankly, both sides really focusing on how important the judiciary is?
That was the takeaway I got from speaking to people on all sides. To be fair, I mean, I did talk to one conservative. He said, you know, I think this is a little overblown reading into it, because basically how the system works now could allow, when liberals have control of the president of the executive branch and the Senate, they could appoint more far left judges. And then ultimately that would balance out. People on the left that I talked to were very adamant that, you know, when there's a Democratic president, that Democratic president should also take the playbook from Trump and push more far left ideological judges. It really looks like, you know, maybe the left is also looking at judiciary kind of in a new light. I also heard, you know, several criticisms that President Obama was far too cautious and looked for more consensus judges. I mean, one of the biggest things to look at is the fact that four circuit court judges, and this is not the case for district court, but four circuit court judges, the Senate does not need to, abide by the blue slip tradition, which, as I said before, gives the home state senators room to block a judge. I would also say that this, you know, on the conservative side, they said, well, this also gives us the ability to put our first choice forward. We can get better quality, more conservative judges. This way, we can get more nominees interested in putting their name in the ring because they know that they'll probably have a better chance of getting confirmed. And Democrats should also welcome this because they will also have this chance when they're in other seats.
When each party has set up the old boogeyman, and the Ninth Circuit has been that for conservatives. If the Ninth Circuit were considered to be more evenly split between conservatives and liberals, well, then what would they have to complain about?
You know, I asked that question, and I actually did speak to one of the senators who this year introduced a bill again to break up the Ninth Circuit, Senator James Risch from Idaho. And he said nothing has changed. The court is too big. It's very, very busy. In fact, it's so busy that sometimes district judges are called in to weigh in on some cases. I asked liberals whether, you know, goes more conservative, they'd be in favor of splitting up the court. And one person told me, well, you know, we'd be adding seats as the solution rather than breaking up the court.
Susanna Luthi of Politico. Susanna, thank you for the time today.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, a hiking trail on the north rim of the Grand Canyon is named after the first National Park Ranger ever killed in the line of duty.
I mean, you don't get a trail named after you in a national park unless you've earned that, so to speak.
The story behind the Ken Patrick Trail from the editor of Arizona Highways magazine coming up.
But first, 200,000 Medicaid patients will now be a part of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona. The patients had been served by Dallas-based Steward Health Choice Arizona, which was acquired by Blue Cross Blue Shield. The move affects some 200,000 people in northern and central Arizona who receive health care through the state's Medicaid system, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, also known as ACCESS. In a news release, Blue Cross Blue Shield Arizona says no significant changes are planned. Joining us to talk about what this acquisition means to patients, healthcare providers, and the rest of us is Jim Hammond. He's CEO and publisher of the Hertel Report, which covers the Arizona healthcare industry. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the significance of this merger?
Well, this puts Blue Cross Blue Shield in all market segments in Arizona. They have long been touted as, you know, a provider of healthcare for all Arizonans, but really the access market segment they have not been active in until now.
Is that
so? That's the big news.
Is that good for a healthcare, like for an insurance provider? We hear so much about how Medicaid doesn't pay that well. You know, the reimbursement rates aren't so good. Is this an industry or a part of the industry that a company like Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona would be hot to get into?
Well, yes. In fact, the Arizona Access Program is a program where the health plans have made money. In fact, just a year ago, Access awarded contracts, new contracts to the managed care plans. And there was unprecedented competition to get into the Medicaid program here in Arizona. So there is money to be made on Medicaid in Arizona.
Jim, let's talk about the difference between a for-profit, out-of-state company to a not-for-profit, Arizona-based company. What sort of difference, if any, does that make?
Well, I think initially you're not going to see much difference. I think it's going to take some time for the Blue Cross Blue Shield culture and systems to take place and to take over from the Steward systems and their culture. But I really don't think that in the long run that the members are going to be impacted that much. The benefit plans are the same. Those are mandated by the state. The whole program is administered and managed by the state. So I don't think that much of this will be different for the members until maybe 2 or 3 years down the road when Blue Cross Blue Shield really takes over and it's their folks that are running it.
Is there any difference for a provider or an insurance company like this in terms of covering Medicaid patients versus private insurance patients?
Well, yes, there are definitely differences. Most of them are in the benefit plan. You know, the most commercial benefit plans have some sort of a balance between patient responsibility and insurance responsibility. With the Access benefit plan, there really is no patient responsibility. So that's the first major difference. The other differences are coverages for certain things like non-emergency medical transportation. We're talking about a different population here that does not have resources. And so Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona will have to change and morph and take on some of the attributes of a Medicaid provider, whereas they've been more of a commercial and Medicare provider until now.
Jim, you follow obviously very closely the state of the healthcare industry in general. I want to ask this in more of a transactional way. Does this indicate that there are other opportunities for a Blue Cross Blue Shield or someone else as our health system changes, becomes in some cases more complicated, in some cases less? I mean, could we see more acquisitions, more mergers of this type?
Well, I think we might be done with them. We've seen some already where Care First, which is now a WellCare company, was recently purchased by Centene. So we saw some consolidation already in this market. And so I don't know if we're going to see any more of this Medicaid acquisitions in the short term. I don't see that happening. But across the industry, absolutely, mergers and acquisitions are happening at a pretty significant clip. There is always something brewing. I don't have any inside information about what might be next in the access world, but I think this is the last big move for a while.
Okay. Jim Hammond, CEO and publisher of the Hertel Report. Jim, thanks for your insights today.
Thank you.
As of January 1st, every new home or multifamily three-story residential building in California has to have its energy powered by solar sources. Developers and builders have had a couple of years to prepare, but there are clear challenges, particularly for smaller companies. And how could it affect the prices in a state where a lack of affordable housing is already a deep concern? To learn more about the impact already being felt and what it could be going forward, I'm joined by Dustin Mulvaney. He's an associate professor at San Jose State University and author of Solar Power, Innovation, Sustainability, and Environmental Justice. Dustin, to what extent will this new California policy affect the overall solar industry and consumers in the state?
Well, it certainly will create more demand for rooftop solar installations in the state. So I think it will have some major effect on solar adoption because as we build new houses, you know, we are in the middle of a housing crisis here in California, so we will be building new houses. That just means they'll all be required to be capable of generating electricity from the rooftop with solar panels.
And is this something that is expected to affect communities specifically? How competitive is California at this point when it comes to either home or industry?
California has been generous with how they've incentivized photovoltaic and or solar panel adoption. So it's been a pretty strong signal to get more consumers to adopt solar. California has pretty expensive electricity prices, so solar tends to be pretty price competitive there. Obviously, like Arizona, California has a lot of sun. So that means that same solar panel will generate more electricity when it's installed in a sunny state compared to a grayer or rainier state. So I think there certainly is a lot of incentives to make this happen.
What are some of the concerns as it relates to, you mentioned housing crisis, affordability already a concern in many areas, but in California, it's off the charts to some extent. I presume that using solar when it comes to this is going to at least lead to initial prices as far as housing going up. How do you see the balancing act there in terms of wanting to get more solar, but also perhaps it increases prices at least for a while?
This is a critical issue in California, of course, both decarbonizing our electricity supply at the same time we have a major housing crisis. So the regulatory agencies really carefully studied what the impacts would be, and they did find that there would be an increase in the cost of a home, but they also found that that home would be cheaper to operate in a longer time frame. So after 8 to 11 years, those solar panels will have paid for themselves. And beyond that, that means you're basically making out on your electricity in terms of what you pay for it. So at the end of the day, what you're seeing here is greater use of rooftop areas as opposed to other places where we see solar, which could have impacts to biodiversity or landscapes and such. So from my perspective, thinking about solar energy adoption holistically means integrating it with the built environment, and the rooftop mandate, I think, helps accomplish that.
So do you think it's more likely to be a win-win in the long run then?
At the end of the day, consumers make out, the landscape makes out. I think even home builders will find that their homes are easier to sell when they have solar panels on them. And that will be actually a selling point for lots of homes, especially as we start to evolve to starting to see energy storage like batteries integrated into the home better. I think you're going to really start to, that's where you really start to see the potential to transform the way we live and get power in this more distributed way, at least for the residential energy use.
You've done so much work and research as it relates to solar generally. How big a step is this? I mean, California tends to be ahead of the pack on a lot of issues. Do you see this starting a trend? Has a trend already begun? Or is California so unique that maybe we won't see this impact in other places for a while?
For this policy, it was really important that California had gone through a very long process of making houses and homes more energy efficient. And this was really seen as the icing on the cake of 40 to 50 years worth of energy efficiency regulation, energy efficiency adoption in the state. So I think states that have gone through that process where they have identified low-hanging energy efficiency fruit from the tree, I could see a rooftop solar mandate being a logical next step. But you really want to make sure homes are energy efficient before you just start tossing solar panels on them. So I think that that's a really critical step for states to take.
And have you seen with the California policy, I know it just went into effect, but it's obviously been in the works for a while. Has there been a feeling that you'll see collaboration between private industry and the government for this sort of thing?
I think so. I think there is an interest in making electricity affordable to consumers and for at least the customers who will have the rooftop solar on, that will make their electricity more affordable. The challenge is now we'll start to see debates about rooftop solar versus utility scale and what portion of our solar supply should come from our rooftops versus at a solar farm that might be in an area that's outside of the city. So that's probably where the tensions are between utility scale solar and rooftop solar. The building industries, I think, are just, this is more, you know, typical for them because they're familiar with having building codes updated. And that's really all this is an update to the building codes.
It seems to come across more in that sense than in the more visionary, innovative sense. But do you think you're heading in California, at least in that direction, for something that would be less about the practicalities and more about a larger vision, whatever that may be?
I think you're going to see a lot of innovation in this space as those solar panels are installed, because now there's going to be an incentive for consumers to install a battery in their basement to help offset some of the higher priced electricity that we are now seeing in states that have a lot of solar, which usually comes after the sun sets. So there's certainly a lot of innovation in there. And then the big picture, California has an issue with wildfires. And we obviously are trying to also remove natural gas and coal from our electricity grid. And by having homes that are capable of generating electricity at home and also storing some of that energy in their batteries, that's going to offer some innovative solutions to the wildfire crisis that we see in California, because now you're capable of generating electricity in certain circuits that you don't have to move it from one part of the country to another. So having these distributed solutions, which the solar mandate encourages, I think will help effectively see this policy through.
Dustin Mulvaney is an associate professor at San Jose State University and author of Solar Power, Innovation, Sustainability, and Environmental Justice. You're listening to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. A few years ago, Yancey Strickler was walking through the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where he lived. Strickler, a co-founder and former CEO of the crowdfunding site Kickstarter, had noticed the neighborhood was changing. But on this day, he realized a popular old dive bar had closed down and was being replaced by a bank branch. There were, he noted, already three other branches of that same bank within a 15-minute walk. And that got him thinking about why his neighborhood was changing and what that might mean. Those thoughts led to his new book called This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World.
And as someone who lived in the neighborhood, I just thought of what, like, how does this make sense? And so I started just asking this question of, like, how does this make sense? Like, this doesn't make sense to me, but this must make sense to someone. And after researching this, I ended up connecting this to why there are so many movie sequels and why Taylor Swift is on the cover of every magazine and why the world is sort of narrowing down to a more limited set of choices. And the phrase I put to this idea is financial maximization, the belief that the right choice in any decision is whichever option makes the most money. And so that, I hadn't thought about it that way before. I hadn't seen that there was sort of a unifying assumption behind a lot of the decisions that were so confusing to me. And so I just kept pulling on that thread, and that led to this book.
So do you think that people, individuals, and businesses, obviously you say that they can both be financial maximizers, but do they go about it in slightly different ways, do you think, or should they go about it in slightly different ways?
Yeah, well, I think people, I mean, for right now, 43% of Americans can't afford their bills every month. So they are like trying to just financially satisfy their needs. So I think for a lot of individuals, we're more thinking that way. Once you become wealthy, though, you know, making more money actually has no meaning to you. Like these are the diminishing returns that economists talk about, like drinking more water after you've already quenched your thirst. But at that point, money is becoming a proxy for self-esteem, for other sorts of things. But the way it's happened on the macro environment of the economy overall, I point to the early 1970s when this change happened, in particular an essay by the economist Milton Friedman in the New York Times arguing that the only responsibility a business has is to maximize profits for shareholders. And this is a very new idea, and businesses really flipped how they operated from that point. In the book, I talk about how we live today in the mullet economy, where if you remember the mullet, the 80s hairstyle that had business in front, party in the back, the mullet economy is that for workers, it has been business in front for the last 50 years. They've gotten a 10% pay raise adjusted for inflation since the early 1970s, a lot of job insecurity. And then for the top 1%, for the owners, for the shareholders, it has been a party in the back.
So from a business perspective, in your mind, what is the right balance in terms of making money, because the business has to make money or it's not going to be in business anymore, while also not just making money and making sure that their workers are getting paid a fair wage and maybe making sure that they're trying to do other good things for society as well?
Yeah, keep in mind that I'm saying this as a former CEO of a company that was profitable, operated in the black from its second year in business. So I've been in the trenches. And with Kickstarter, what we ultimately did is we became a public benefit corporation. This is a for-profit company that is legally required to balance on a level playing field, producing financial returns for shareholders with producing a positive benefit for society. I think that this is not the ultimate answer on its own, but it's a part of it, because I was CEO when Kickstarter converted to become a public benefit corporation, and I could feel the difference, because in the past, our values, our beliefs were like these guardrails. You know, you would bang into them when you went astray, but they were still kind of passive. But as a public benefit corporation where these things are legally binding, where they're put into your charter that these are things you must do, they become more like drivers, and they become more active things that you just feel an obligation to pursue. And so I think that on the macro level, what we're going to get to is just that financial and non-financial values need to be on a level playing field.
Well, how big of a shift in the business world in thinking would it be for more businesses to think that way?
Well, I mean, it's a big one, but it's not unprecedented. You know, in the 1950s and 1960s, American companies operated very differently. There, they retained employees, they reinvested in retraining, they invested heavily in R&D. And at that time, you know, America's national focus was on growing the middle class. So it's not unprecedented at all. It's just not what we're used to. I think what you saw earlier this year with the Business Roundtable, which is made up of the 200 or so largest companies in America, saying that companies should think about all stakeholders, not just shareholders, that's a rhetorical shift, but those rhetorical shifts matter. And I also think it's no surprise or no coincidence that the market leaders in various industries, companies like Chick-fil-A or Patagonia, are people that distinguish themselves in part by having a broader sense of value, right? Like Chick-fil-A is closed on Sundays when every other major chain is open. They're willing to give up $1 billion a year in profits for some other value. This helps make Chick-fil-A distinct in the marketplace. Same with Patagonia and all the pledges they do around helping the environment. Right now, we maybe think of those as like PR stunts or something like that, but I think they might actually reflect a deeper sense of values and ones that consumers will reward, that employees will want to be a part of.
In that scenario, though, you sort of lose the benefit of being sort of the outlier, right? Like if every fast food restaurant is closed on Sunday, not just Chick-fil-A, Chick-fil-A isn't sort of special anymore. So do businesses and maybe consumers have to think about this a little differently? You know, if REI and every other outdoor store is also sharing what it knows and trying to do good for the environment, not just Patagonia, Patagonia is not so special, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would love that world. You know, I would love for Kickstarter to not be the weirdo indie company that did these things. I'd love to be more normal. You know, I root for like a reverse takeover of PBCs taking over traditional C Corps. I agree that then probably you would have to try to distinguish yourself in other ways, but that sounds great to me. If that becomes the new competitive front, yeah, putting competition around growing non-financial value would be an amazing thing.
All right, that is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. His new book is called This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World. Yancey, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Ken Patrick was almost predestined to have a deep connection to the Grand Canyon. He moved there with his parents as a young child. His dad worked helping to build trails, and his mom later was an operator for the phone line that connected the North and South Rims. As a teen, he returned to the Grand Canyon after leaving home in the Midwest. He later worked for the National Park Service, but it was at a park in California where Ken Patrick was murdered.
In the early 1970s, there was a meat shortage, so poaching became a big concern in most national parks. And so Ken was just out one morning to do a routine check to search for poachers, was driving up a hill, looked like these guys were going the wrong way, and he ended up pulling them over, and at one point asked one of the guys in the car to move the coat, and he had a crossbow, which was what these guys were using to poach the deer. And in that moment, the guy in the passenger seat pulled out a pistol and shot and killed Ken Patrick, and he became, at that time, the first park ranger in the history of the National Park Service to be killed in the line of duty.
That's Robert Steve, editor-in-chief of Arizona Highways magazine. He wrote about Ken Patrick in the January edition of the magazine, which is dedicated to the Grand Canyon. Patrick is buried at the Grand Canyon, and there's a trail named after him at the North Rim. It's a trail Steve has hiked before, and while he recognized the name, he didn't know that much about Ken Patrick's story.
Yeah, you know, we get a lot of calls and letters from people from all over the world, and a lot of people have great story ideas. And this woman called me from up in Payson and said, you know, and she was tying it to the centennial of Grand Canyon National Park. She says, oh, here's something that you might be interested in. And she talked about how she's a nurse and takes care of this woman who's 102 years old, a woman named Pansy Greer, who moved to the canyon in the 1930s, and she had this amazing photo album with all these great old photos, and her husband helped build the trails there and things like that. And she thought, I might be interested in looking at this photo album. And then sort of in passing, she mentioned that Pansy was the mother of Ken Patrick. And to your point, yeah, it sounded familiar. I you know, was familiar with the name. And then it sort of confused me that Ken Patrick's mother could still be alive, right? And so one thing led to another, and I finally met Pansy and started learning more about her son and started digging into the story.
What did she have to say about her son and sort of his legacy at the canyon? Because the way he died was really, really terrible.
Yeah, you know, she gets choked up. I mean, she's 102 and sharp as a tack, so she remembers, you know, that day and that time as if it happened yesterday. And his legacy at the canyon is very powerful. I mean, the guy did everything you could do at the canyon and just was in love with the canyon. And so, you know, when she talks about, you know, her son and what happened to him, it's a tough story for her.
You also got to speak with Ken Patrick's widow as well, right?
I did. Yeah, she was amazing. Her name is Tommy, and she is just like Pansy. I mean, sharp as a tack. Actually, Tommy, after her husband died, joined the National Park Service, eventually became a ranger herself and a superintendent up in Alaska. So she, you know, got swept up in this whole allure of the National Park Service. But, you know, she'd never spoken much about what had happened to her husband. She'd never talked to the media per se. And like her mother-in-law, she can remember every detail as if it happened yesterday.
What do you think led her to break her silence and decide, okay, I'm ready to talk about this really heartbreaking chapter of her life?
You know, when I asked her that, she said it's basically time. You know, it's been 50 years since this happened. And, you know, she you don't ever get over it, but you start to deal with it. So she, you know, and I think, you know, some of it has to do with Arizona Highways, too. You know, the respect for the publication and, you know, understanding that, you know, like KJZZ, we tell good stories. And I think she trusted us.
So we talked about the fact that you have hiked this trail a number of times. How would you describe it? Like, what's it like?
Oh, you know what? I get, as editor of this magazine, I get asked a lot about the best hikes in the state. And it's always hard to choose, but I usually, you know, when I'm forced to answer that question, I go to the North Rim, and the Ken Patrick Trail is one of those trails up there where the wonder of these trails is that it's, you know, they skirt one of the seven natural wonders of the world, right? But you also go through these amazing alpine forests, and you get a little bit of everything, and more than anything, you get the solitude up there. And Ken Patrick is a trail that just not many people go on. So if you're looking to get away from the 6 or 7 million people visiting, you know, the South Rim, you can go up to the North Rim and hike this great trail.
After having spoken to both his widow and his mother, do you think about your time on that trail and maybe what it looked like and that idea of solitude? Do you think about that a little differently now?
Oh, you know, absolutely. And, you know, I'm actually anxious to get back up there once the snow melts and go do this trail again after having, you know, met Ken's family and getting out there. It's a beautiful trail, and it's an opportunity to experience the canyon, but then think about, well, I said this to Tommy. I said, you know, I mean, if you want a memorial, you couldn't ask for a better one than a trail up on the North Rim of the Grand Canyon.
What does Ken Patrick's legacy seem to still be at the Grand Canyon? Obviously, he has a trail named after him. He's buried at the canyon. But when you talk to people who work there, who know about the canyon, who are sort of steeped in its traditions, what is his legacy?
Yeah, good question. You know, everybody I talk to, you know, knows Ken Patrick. They know the story about Ken Patrick. Maybe not all the details, but they understand, you know, the important role that he played in the canyon and what his legacy is. And there's a reverence for him, for sure. I mean, you don't get a trail named after you in a national park unless you've earned that, so to speak. And, you know, everybody I spoke to was actually so pleased to hear that this story was being told, because I think, you know, in their inner circles, they know that story. And it's one of those things, boy, I really wish the world would know more about this great man.
In talking to the people who knew him best, what was behind his love of the Grand Canyon?
You know, I think it's one of those things, Mark, where, you know, some people can walk up to the Grand Canyon and look out there and make a few photos and check it off their list and then get back in the car and go home. Some people just get, you know, hooked into the magic of the Grand Canyon. It just, you know, how it just, it's so beautiful and it's so different every day. And, you know, he moved there as a very young boy. He was 3 or 4 years old. And so it was, you know, some of his earliest memories certainly were of this massive canyon out there. And, you know, he did move away briefly. His parents eventually moved back to Indiana. And then he basically ran away from home. You know, that go west young man spirit was in him. And he, it took him a year to get from Indiana back to the Grand Canyon. But that's how determined he was to get there and spend his life there.
All right. That is Robert Steeve, editor-in-chief of Arizona Highways Magazine. Robert, it's always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Time for the first Friday newscap of 2020. Our panelists today, communications consultant Julie Earthly of Earthly Uncuffed and former state superintendent of public instruction Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So as we were just discussing, this was a nice holiday week. So not a lot of stuff to discuss as of the week that was. So we're going to look a little bit ahead. Julie, let's start with redistricting, the possibility of that, because we heard this week, and we've been hearing talk about this, the census numbers, is Arizona going to get a 10th congressional district? Right. First of all, how significant is that? How much do you think the parties are going to fight over? We have no idea how they're going to be drawn at this point, but is this a time that Arizona moving more purple, could we see a competitive seat? What are your thoughts on that, generally?
Oh, boy. The Independent Redistricting Commission is going to be a huge fight. It actually already has. As we know, so there is a, you know, the appellate court, the Commission on Appellate Court Appointees is basically a commission that decides which candidates the parties can choose from for those all-important 5 commission members for the Independent Redistricting Commission. And Democrats are already quite upset over this because they believe that that commission has been stacked. The governor, in his last round of appointments, did not appoint a single Democrat. In contrast, Janet Napolitano had appointed 7 Republicans to that commission. And so Democrats are already saying, listen, this is a commission that is supposed to represent the diversity of Arizona, and it does not. And so the fighting has already started. And I think what we can be assured of going into this process is that there's going to be a lot of time in litigation.
I mean, it's a third go-round for the IRC. First time around, Republicans seem to have the advantage. Last time around, and there's that fifth independent seat, which the person is ostensibly an independent, but as we've seen, person leans one way or the other. It's so huge in terms of deciding that. What do you make of how big the IRC, how big a story that will be for us as we move toward the end of 2020?
I agree. It's going to be a very significant story. And one of the things you're going to see this time around, I think in the last redistricting process, the Republicans really did drop the ball. I think they didn't. They left it up to the party apparatus to really drive it and develop the resources and the technical expertise. And they didn't really have any. And you could see the Democrats, I think, ran circles around the Republicans and the maps that were drawn. Ostensibly, they were still, like District 9 was a Republican, quote-unquote, district. But it really benefited, as we've seen, every Democrat has won pretty handily. So I think now you're going to see much more of an engagement from the outside in. I think there's going to be, you know, the party is going to be front and center, but you're going to see a lot more interest making sure that that process is going to be, you know, from a Republican standpoint, a little bit more competitive this time around.
Are there particular members of Arizona's delegation that either of you think should be concerned about having their districts redrawn or losing particular constituencies, especially if we get another seat?
Well, if you just look at the one I just mentioned, I think a Greg Stanton, for instance, is already looking at possible other opportunities. You know, his name keeps popping up for possibly a U.S. Senate if things work out, you know, and the Republicans win. And then McSally would have to run again in two more years. For the governor position, his name keeps being popped up. And I think one of the reasons is I think there's a doubt that that district is going to be as probably as safe as it is now for a Democrat. Again, if it turns out the Republicans are able to manage it better than they did last time. Tom O'Halloran in District 1, that has always been, you know, by and large, a Republican
and
area.
And a huge, huge district.
And a huge district. But the Democrats were able to draw that in a way that they were able to capture a lot of areas that helped out O'Halloran. So I think just off the top of my head, those are the two. But again, now if the Democrats are able to control the process and do a better job, just like they did last time, you might see them be more competitive in areas that you may not think, like a Schweikert district, for instance.
Correct.
Julie,
correct.
What do you think?
No, I agree. I think it's all going to come down to who is able to, like Jaime said, have that control in ultimately drawing the maps and figuring out what it means to be competitive. And of course, each party has a different idea of what it means to be competitive. So will these districts essentially be competitive in the voters' minds? Meaning, will there be an opportunity for either a Republican or a Democrat to win a district? I'm not so sure. And I think that is the biggest concern by Democrats, of course, because they want these competitive districts because, as we saw in the last go-round, they were able to capture those districts when they were much more competitive.
I mean, without going too far in the weeds, when you say, because those of us in this room have talked about how Republicans dropped the ball or Democrats took advantage the last time around. What does it mean that the Republicans dropped the ball? How much influence can actually be had there? Because I thought this was supposed to be independent. I'm confused.
See, that's the thing what I love about all of these so-called initiatives that are supposed to get interests out of elections. You know, politics is it's a fight. And so you're seeing this independent redistricting commission, not really independent. And so one of the things that happens, what the Democrats did is when they looked at the maps, they looked at the strength of people actually going out to vote. So they might have said, okay, well, Republicans, here you go. You can have more Republicans in that district. Everybody thinks, well, it's going to lean Republican because they have more. But they really had more Democrats that were more enthusiastic voters than the Republicans were. So things like that, where it takes a lot of data, it takes a lot of mining of information that really drives this process, and you have to have people that really know what they're doing. Again, the last time Democrats did a great job of figuring that out, getting people, national folks, to come in and help with that kind of information, and I think the Republicans kind of dropped the ball. But this time around, you're just not going to see that happen because of what occurred last time.
Is it safe to say that no matter what happens, I mean, Julie, you alluded to this, we've seen the first two go-rounds end up in court for years in both cases. I mean, is this going to be the, you know, Attorney Full Employment Act again when the next legislative and congressional maps are drawn?
I think without a doubt, if there's anybody that stands to benefit from this, it's a handful of attorneys who are going to do great in the next few years. And as Jaime said, you know, And as I alluded to earlier, the fight has already started. It started with the Commission on Appellate Court appointees, and there's going to be some more appointments coming up. It's going to be a huge fight, and I think this is going to be the topic of many stories over the next year and more.
We're just a little over a week away from the governor's State of the State address, next legislative session. It's an election year. Julie, hopes of bipartisanship on anything? We saw a little bit as it related to the drought contingency plan. That was sort of had to happen that way.
Right.
Education funding on certain aspects of it a little bit. But what do you think about coming up, especially heading into an election year?
I think it's wishful thinking. I do think that there is an opportunity, particularly actually when it comes to criminal justice reform. I think there's an opportunity there. Unfortunately, though, the sort of all-powerful committee chairs who need to see that legislation through, Representative John Allen, Senator Eddie Farnsworth, they are not really open to criminal justice reform. And so if there is any hope of bipartisanship on that issue, the governor will have to take an active role. And I just haven't seen a willingness from the Ninth Floor to take that on. So I think the reality is that there are a number of opportunities for bipartisanship. It's unlikely. Even when it comes to criminal justice reform, I think their biggest hope of any kind of real reform is going to come through an initiative, to be totally honest. I just don't see it happening at the legislature.
Jaime, Julie did not mention education funding or anything related to that. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. The steam that was in that pot, right? Remember that we saw the last couple of years with the Red for Ed movement, really has dissipated to some extent. And I think a lot of it was because you have constant, and the governor's done a good job about this. I mean, he's constantly talked about the increases in funding, and he's made that a staple of everything. You know, he's talked about it consistently. And he's also, every time you do social media, he always talks about, you know, how much teachers are getting raises, and they've made that front and center. And so this 20 by 20, the 20% increases by 20 this next fiscal year, I think you're going to see an addition to that because they are in a better position. Being an election year, I think they can then tout, well, see, we actually did 25 by 20. So the polling data that I've seen shows that people still want to see more funding in the schools. They still want to see teachers get increases. But whether or not they want to raise taxes to do it, because I think they're seen from this echo chamber, no, it's being taken care of, so we really don't have to. So I think that's – and then the other reason, just purely political, I think the left, and particularly the Education Association, the Arizona Education Association, sees the opportunity of, well, why do we want to give them an out by doing an initiative that takes the pressure off, where we could use that as a campaign issue? Because if you think about it, this can become a very powerful tool that the Democrats can use if they figure out that this is not – being taken care of, quote unquote. And so I think this is something that's not going to be done as far as an initiative goes or a referendum this time around.
I think there's still the possibility of an education initiative. It's becoming less likely as time goes on. It's still possible. One thing that people aren't talking about that could come into play during this legislative session is, you know, there is a lawsuit out there for funding, you know, about $2 billion in cuts to capital funding for schools, for building maintenance and repair, for soft capital such as textbooks and technology. There is a massive lawsuit out there that is in the process right now, and that's been going on for several years. I don't know when this lawsuit is going to come to a head, but many people anticipate it could be in a short amount of time. If this happens during legislative session, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that schools will likely be owed. And so this surplus that we keep talking about could be gone in an instant if that's the case. The state has been down this road before. They lost. I anticipate they will lose again. And at some point, these schools are going to have to be made whole. So I think this could still be a huge issue when it comes to 2020. And whether that's at the legislature, whether that's in races for the state legislature or an initiative, I don't see the issue of education going away anytime soon.
I mean, Julie mentioned sort of a dirty S word at the Capitol, surplus. Nobody wants to use that word, it seems. The conventional wisdom is often that it is easier to do a budget when there's no money because Correct. You just say no to everybody as That's opposed right. to having to pick winners and losers to some extent. in an election year, people want to be done soon because they have to get out and campaign for their seats or for other offices. Do you see the fiscal situation maybe keeping lawmakers in session a little bit longer this year?
I do. I think that that's always the case. I mean, it's, like you said, it's easier to cut and than it is to figure out, okay, who's going to be the winners and losers. This time around, I think the winners, if there is going to be winners, is going to be education funding. I think they're going to see an increase, but also infrastructure, because infrastructure is the easiest thing you can do as one-time dollars. So I think you're going to see quite a bit of resources go into the highway users fund, the HERF fund, because that can be spread out across the state. It can be used to, you know, grease the votes, if so to speak. I know you know that you're shocked. You know that that's
what now?
But when legislators can go back to their districts and say, yeah, we're going to have money for get these roads fixed. And in rural Arizona, that's a massive issue. And it's starting to become a bigger and bigger issue. But even in Pima County, you know, you can go to Republicans in even in the northern side. That's the one issue that they'll say that they want to have happen is infrastructure funding. So those are the kinds of things that can get done that might help with the budget process.
Yeah, and I think corrections as well. That's one area that we can't ignore. We saw recently with the broken locks, you know, and the legislature being willing, saying, listen, we need safety, not just for our inmates, but for our corrections officers. And these corrections officers are leaving in many of the, much in the same way that our teachers are leaving. They have very low pay. We need to get qualified corrections officers into our prisons. And so I think that that's going to be an area that's going to be pulling on those surplus dollars as well. And I think perhaps if there's any bipartisanship, that would be the one area where you would see bipartisanship, is that, yes, we need to fix some of these problems in our prisons.
So before the break, I'm not going to ask you guys to peg a certain legislative district or anything like that. But do you see changes in certain districts, either predicted or unpredicted, or surprise or not surprise, that will either strengthen the Republican majority a little bit or where Democrats can gain? I mean, do you see Democrats gaining a seat or two? Do you see Republicans gaining a seat or two in either body?
Yes. The short answer is yes. I do think Democrats have a very strong opportunity to pick up a couple seats in the House.
In areas they've been gaining ground, Julie, or what sort of area?
Yes. So I think in areas where they've been gaining ground, also I think, for instance, in LD21, I think there's an opportunity there with Kathy Connect running as a Democrat, as a single-shot candidate against two Republican. They are both Republican incumbents, but I still think that there's an opportunity. She has a really
strong— Had she run as an independent before?
Correct. Yes. Okay. She ran as an independent, and she ran for the Senate. Now she's running for the House. So I think there's an opportunity there as well. And I think, you know, one of the big matchups besides LD6, I think there's obviously an opportunity in LD6 as well, particularly on the House side. But on the Senate side, you have this matchup again between Kate Brophy McGee and Christine Marsh, former Arizona Teacher of the Year. That was decided by just a couple hundred votes. There's going to be another huge matchup there again.
Okay. And I mean, we don't have Kyrsten Sinema running this time around, which may have helped Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And a lot of this is, let's face it, I mean, it's driven from the top down, right? How the presidential politics is playing nationally, how the U.S. Senate race is going. That tends to affect all
you
the down-ticker
our next
races.
Segment. Thank you.
But the one thing that I think is hurting is helping the Republicans right now are the Democrats. Because right now there's somewhat of a civil war going on within the Democratic base, where you have the leadership of the Democratic Party that's hoping to become Speaker, Charlene Fernandez. They're actually going and trying to recruit candidates in primaries against incumbent Democrats. So if you think about all those resources that could be going to these races like 21, where it should be going if you think about it, they're trying to purge of the what they consider to be the more not really Democrats. You know, as the Republicans call the rhinos, I don't know what the term is for the Democrats, but they don't think they're Democrat enough. And so that's, to me, it's nonsensical on its face, but it's something that I assure you will help the Republicans if that continues. And it's starting to become a very big fight internally.
Julie, can you give us 20 seconds on that?
I don't think there's a lot of party resources going to those sort of inner party fights. And so I think you're going to see primaries in Democratic-controlled districts, but the focus is still going to be in those competitive districts.
Okay. That's Julie Earthly. Also here is Jaime Molero with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. Mm-hmm. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest today, our former state superintendent of public instruction, Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez, and communications consultant, Julie Earthly of Earthly Uncuffed.
So we are about a couple months away now from the presidential preference election. The Republicans have decided not to have one this year. Donald Trump will be the nominee here. Julie, how is it looking on the Democratic side? We just saw one candidate drop out this week, Julian Castro of Texas. How is the race shaping up at this point in Arizona?
You know, it's interesting because I actually thought that Joe Biden's strength would not remain as high as it has over the course of the last few months, but he's maintaining. And I think right now what's happening is most Democrats just see him as the safest choice. However, if something, I think this is highly unlikely, but if something were to happen to Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders and one of them dropped out of the race, I think it would actually become much more competitive because you would see the progressives line up behind one of those candidates.
Whichever one's left.
Correct. Exactly. But I think by and large, you know, Vice President Biden just has that momentum. And I think here in Arizona, that plays actually quite well because he's considered more moderate. He's sort of, you know, back to the Obama era, which they're comfortable with. So I think it's more about comfort right now and this idea of who can beat Donald Trump. And right now, he is still seen as the individual most likely to beat Donald Trump.
Jaime, has the issue of electability changed since Donald Trump, who a lot of people thought was not electable, he won? Has the notion of electability changed?
Yes, I think that absolutely has. And I think in a lot of ways to the detriment of the Democrats this time around, because if you think about it, look at the numbers that Buttigieg and Sanders in particular, their last quarter fundraising just eclipsed what Biden was able to do. And I think a lot of it is because a lot of Democrats are thinking to themselves, well, if Donald Trump can win the primary, why couldn't a Bernie Sanders do it? And I think if you play that out from a Republican standpoint, that is the best scenario that you can have happen, is if they do decide to go with an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or somebody that's seen as so progressive on the left that just polling numbers show that that's where the Republicans and, of course, Donald Trump becomes a lot stronger. So that's where a lot of the dynamics, because of the Trump factor, as I call it, has turned politics on its head. Whereas Biden, I would say, yeah, you know, some states like Arizona might have momentum, but in a lot of other states where it's going to be key battlegrounds, boy, he's stumbling.
So the conventional wisdom has been, over the last few months, that if Joe Biden, let's say, were the nominee ultimately, whether or not he wins the Arizona presidential preference election, but if Biden is the nominee, that might put a state like Arizona in play come November. Do you think the conventional wisdom?
Sure. Oh yeah, that's always the wisdom. But there's so many factors. Right now we're barely starting the first inning of a long game, and there's so many things like, you know, the economy. If the economy continues to increase and move in a positive clip, of course that helps the incumbent. This impeachment inquiry, it's interesting how that's kind of fallen off the radar, but it's still out there. And as that continues to play on, it seems as though, again, polling data shows it tends to help President Trump and the Republicans. So there's a lot of factors going on, so I think it's still too early to tell. However, if the Democrats continue to move towards a very hard progressive positions, I think that ultimately not just helps the president, it helps all the down ticket.
Julie, how challenging is this for Democrats generally? Because there are people who are not necessarily party activists who will say, well, you should make the practical choice,
right?
But more activists will say, well, wait a second, why are we going to try to sort of go back to what it was? We need to be something a little bit different. And then others will say, well, if you want that, why would you nominate a nearly 70-year-old senator from Massachusetts or someone who's not even technically a Democrat in Bernie Sanders?
You know, the reality is these kinds of sort of inter-party squabbles happen all the time. And you see it on both sides. It's more likely to happen when you have a whole host of candidates, right? When you have somebody who's running against an incumbent president. So I don't think it's really all that unusual. And I think, again, it'll play out. It may be that Biden ends up winning because of this, because we have Warren and Senator Sanders splitting this progressive vote. However, at the end of the day, I think Democrats are going to rally around whoever the nominee is. And I think, you know, by and large, what they want is they just want Donald Trump defeated. That is, you know, that's the number one issue. And I think to go back just a little bit to these issues that could crop up that could be huge, we may be in a war or a conflict with Iran. And if that happens, boy, does that change the game.
Let me throw in one more naive question related to money, and I want to have you both talk about this. Mark mentioned that Julian Castro had dropped out, someone who was actually seemed to be popular here in Arizona, mm-hmm. former cabinet secretary and person of Latino descent, right. and one would think that would be appealing to Democrats. Is the system just so controlled, even more than we thought, by just money? Because he never had a chance to get it. He's not going to be in any caucuses, any primaries. He's already out. Kamala Harris, another person. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say the system is a little flawed might be understating it, but I mean, he seemed like someone who would be appealing for Democrats, and he's not even in.
But if you think about it, you know, where was Mayor Buttigieg 9 months ago? You know, people think, well, he's a good guy, we like him, but nah, not really a serious candidate. But now he's come to be one of the front runners in the Democratic primary. So, yes, money plays a big difference. I think when you're a Yang or a Bloomberg or even a Tom Steyer, you're seeing them all over the place because they have the resources to, but they still haven't been able to break out even with that money. So it's a combination of message, the person that's delivering that message, and being able to resonate with the voters that they're trying to get at. Donald Trump was a perfect example. Now, he had the resources because he had his own wealth, but that message was something that even all these other candidates, just as well-funded, couldn't break through. So the messaging is just as important as the money behind it.
Obviously, messaging is key. And, you know, as a communications consultant, that's usually the number one thing that I talk about. You have to understand the message. I think on the Democratic side, however, there are a number of folks like myself who are personally a little disappointed with where things are going. It is... I find it hard to believe that a female candidate who perhaps is a mayor of a town of 100,000 people would ever be considered to be a presidential contender. I don't think, one, she would ever consider running, or two, that she would be given the kind of media attention that Mayor Buttigieg has received. So I think that there is still, unfortunately, a long way for women to go, and in particular, women of color. And that may have more to do with the fact that we've seen people like Kamala Harris, supremely qualified, not being able to raise those funds. There's still this underlying reality that it's just harder for certain candidates to break through.
I remember when people used to say that about Republicans.
Julie, are there particular issues? You mentioned a number, the two of you have mentioned a number of things that ultimately could affect the presidential race come November. Are there particular issues that you think will be on voters' minds in March when they are deciding which Democrat they would like to be their nominee?
Definitely.
Other than, I guess, who can beat Donald Trump?
Right. Well, who can beat Donald Trump, again, I think will be first and foremost in their minds. But at the end of the day, it's family security. That's what's so important. That's what you're going to see play out in Arizona elections. That's what you're going to see play out in national elections. You know, we hear so often from businesses that they need this security. They need to know from year to year where their taxes are going to be and what they can expect. Families need that too. They need to know that if their daughter has a brain tumor, that they're not going to go bankrupt trying to help her. They need to know that if they send their child down the street to the school, that they're going to have a qualified teacher in front of their classrooms. So those kitchen table concepts, healthcare, dreamers, the economy, those definitely will play a role in their minds.
We need to wrap on a quickie on that for the issues.
No, and that's true. But I think, again, the economy is so important in any presidential election year. And as we're seeing, the economy continues to grow at a very healthy clip. People are feeling like, if you, again, looking at the trends in the polling data, folks are saying they may not like, quote-unquote, the president and, you know, his diatribes, but they see things improving. They see things getting more comfortable for them and their families. Savings are going up. Debt is starting to go down. I mean, those are the things that make a big difference in a presidential election year, and right now that benefits Republicans.
Okay. Jaime Malera of Malera Alvarez, Julie Earthly of Earthly Uncuffed. Guys, thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what does it mean to be a Phoenician in 2020? One author has a suggestion.
Bring at least 2 liters of water and have your GPS set and charge your phone. But by all means, go out to the desert and experience the heat as it hits down on the desert, pounds you like a sledgehammer.
We'll talk with Tom Zellner about Phoenix's changing identity. That's just ahead.
But first, technology was a big player in the news in 2019. Since 2016, there's been a lot of attention on how technology was used to influence our election. But it's also influenced the relationship between Democrats and big tech, specifically Facebook. During the Obama era, Democrats celebrated their relationship with Facebook. Today, it's become a little more complicated. Here's WNYC's Amy Walter with a closer look.
This was 2011.
Sorry, I'm kind of nervous. We have the President of the United States here.
My name is Barack Obama, and I'm the guy who got Mark to wear a jacket and tie. Thank you. And in fact, if you'd like, Mark, we can take our jackets off.
Okay. No, that's good.
Whew, that's better, isn't it?
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg with President Barack Obama at Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto, California. And this was from last October.
It should be clear why we have serious concerns about your plan.
So, Mr. Zuckerberg, yes or no, is it still your policy to ban hate groups?
My understanding is yes.
So you won't take down lies or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no.
Congresswoman.
Mr. Zuckerberg, yes or no, does this meet your community standards?
I'm not sure I'm in a position right now to...
I don't think that's a hard question.
You plan on doing no fact-checking on political ads.
Our policy is that we do not fact-check politicians' speech.
Would you be willing to act as a content monitor?
I'm not sure that it would best serve our community for me to spend that much time.
Reclaiming my time.
Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad.
My, have times changed. That, of course, was Mark Zuckerberg testifying in front of the House Financial Services Committee. The hearing's focus was on Facebook's plan for a cryptocurrency. But let's be honest, Zuckerberg can't go anywhere these days without being asked about transparency and trust. And it's clear that since the 2016 election, big tech has fallen out of favor with the Democrats.
We have a massive crisis in our democracy with the way these tech companies are being used.
You get to be the umpire in the baseball game, or you get to have a team.
They have an outsized influence on people's perceptions about issues.
We need to set very tough, very clear, transparent rules.
Start talking about this as a pro-competition issue.
It's time to fight back.
And while many of us are also frustrated by the power and influence these tech companies have on our lives and our economy, they are an inescapable part of it. These big tech companies are embedded in the social and economic fabric of our country. They've bought up the competition, they control our data, and have few government regulations. But how exactly did we get here?
I think it's a great question, and a classic American story of premature triumphalism.
That's Tim Wu. He's the author of The Curse of Bigness and a professor at Columbia University.
You know, about 15 years ago, the internet was held up as the model of the competitive capitalist market where anyone could, with a shoebox or something, open a company and or a blog or anything and take on the giants. And, you know, nothing mattered anymore. Size, scale, big and small was meaningless. But around the turn of the decade and accelerating through the 2010s, the old economic forces reasserted themselves. Scale did start to matter. Brand mattered. And the accumulation of data in a few places mattered. The problem was that the laws and the enforcement of the laws was still predicated on the idea that the internet was a Valhalla of perfect competition, that it was competition is only a click away, that there was no reason to be worried about anything because, well, even if Facebook bought a competitor, Facebook might be gone in a year anyway, so better to stay out. And so I think we sort of acquiesced in the monopolization of the tech industries based on this rosy premise that somehow they'd overcome the basic rules of economics.
Is that the reason then why the normal regulatory bodies did not jump on this sooner to start asking the questions that we're asking now?
I'd point particularly to a failure of merger control, the system for preventing companies from buying their competitors. In this sort of rosier view that everything was fine and this was the perfect industry, everybody somehow became okay with over 300 or 400 buyouts of companies. There's been a massive wave of mergers. I think Standard Oil in the 19th century is the relevant comparison. So yeah, I think that everybody sort of stood down for a while and hoped that the invisible hand would fix it all. And that's how we got here today.
Huh? Did they maybe not understand what was happening? I mean, we know the Standard Oil comparison. If this were a mining company, if this were a grocery supermarket chain, whatever it is, most people understand how those things work. Technology, well, that's really not, for especially people of a certain age, not something they're comfortable with.
No, I don't actually think that's true. I mean, I guess I was in government during then, and so it would be not they, but me as one of the people. I don't think we didn't understand these companies. I think we were more generally living in an era of abandonment of antitrust in particular. You know, you mentioned supermarkets and other industries. We also allowed everybody else to merge, too. You know, this is a period over which AT&T came back, over which we allowed the airlines to merge down to three airlines. We allowed insurance to consolidate. So actually, tech was part of a much larger permissiveness across the economy and even through administrations that just allowed mergers and consolidation of industry with without a lot of control. So actually, I don't think it's right that tech got special treatment. I think everybody was allowed to merge as they liked.
This went across this is the Clinton administration, this is the Bush administration, This is the Obama administration, right? This wasn't just
party. I think there was a rosy view of tech. I don't think, you know, based on my own experience, that, you know, the stereotype of 80-year-olds and, you know, can't understand tech and what's going on here and what's my grandson playing with. You know, that's actually not a bad description of Congress, but I don't think in the administrations that was exactly what it was. They're smart people. There was just an incredible faith that everything would work out by itself, a commitment to sort of a laissez-faire and a tendency towards inaction that was across the economy, frankly, and has led in a lot of directions. You know, a lot of our inequality problems, I think, also stem from that attitude. But I don't think it's limited to tech. I just think tech was a beneficiary of it.
When we go back in time, I mean, the idea of breaking up, this is, I think, a really important point, because it's not as if government hasn't taken on monopolies in the recent past. I was around for the breakup of AT&T. You had the Microsoft antitrust case. So there was a will to do these things. We know what the process looks like. So you're making the argument, not that we, as the American regulatory system, can't regulate big tech, but just that they chose not to.
That's exactly right. The argument you'll hear sometimes that the law is too slow to keep up with tech, it just moves so fast what you can do, I think those are very specious arguments and, in fact, conceal a certain anti-democratic impulse. You know, the fastest moving industries 100 years ago were the oil industry and the telephone industry. And you know, we broke up those industries, especially oil, back then. Cinema was a new and fast-changing industry that was broken up and I'm talking about the early 20th century. So every industry, every generation says, oh, you know, we're new, we're different, you can't really keep up with us, the law doesn't. But, you know, the law is ancient, it relies on a monopoly of force, and that hasn't become irrelevant, let's just put it that way. And even within recent memory, as you point out, Microsoft was subjected to a very serious antitrust suit by the government, and once again, everyone said, oh, you know, they moved too fast, software is too virtual, and, well, it just wasn't true.
The other argument that gets made is, well, unlike AT&T, for example, breaking up AT&T, if you, quote-unquote, break up big tech, you are opening up the market to the Chinese. And the Chinese are going to come in with their technology. They're already prepared to do this, which has, you know, nefarious actors involved, specifically the Chinese government. And that is the reason that maybe, yes, some regulation, but breaking it up would be harmful to American security. Do you buy that argument?
I am very resistant to that form of fear-mongering. I don't think that the national security of the United States depends on Facebook, Google, and Amazon being in their current form. The same arguments were made back in the 70s and 80s with Japan, and the idea was that if you messed with AT&T or IBM, that Japan would come to rule the universe. Well, we did break up AT&T. We put IBM through the ringer, and actually America got stronger from that process. Its tech industries became more vigorous, more vibrant, and it ultimately left Japan in the dust. So I think America does better when it doesn't choose a couple national champions and say, you know, these companies are special. They're immune from government, maybe immune from competition. They're our favored little children. That is the way to lose to the Chinese. Let's just put it that way.
The more that I sort of dig into this stuff and listen to people like you and others who are thinking 10, 20, 50 years down the road, the more worried I am that we're going to end up in some sort of dystopian future. Should I be this scared, or should I be more optimistic about what the future could look like?
No, I think there's reason to be scared. The history of the 20th century has some harsh lessons about the possibility of behavioral control and effective use of propaganda and misuse of information, both to control a population but also to manipulate it. I think that no society should ever be completely calm about the possibility of centralized power with access, especially exclusive access to certain forms of information. So yeah, we're talking about big stakes here, and you know, can get lost in a conversation about whether, you know, Amazon is treating its vendors right or something, which, you know, it's a smaller thing. But the big stakes and the big questions here are all about the power that comes from control of information. And we've seen terrifying things done with that before, and I hope we can somehow collectively prevent terrifying things being done in the future.
Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School and author of The Curse of Bigness.
That is Amy Walter at the Cook Political Report and The Takeaway, and you're listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. And now we turn to our co-host Lauren Gilger with a conversation that takes a look back at the Arizona of 2019 and how the rest of the world sees us.
2019 was not the year of nuanced takes on life in Phoenix and Arizona in general. There were headlines like 100 degrees for days, the looming Phoenix heat wave that could harm thousands from Vox, and as Phoenix heats up, the night comes alive from the New York Times that, despite some lovely photography, really seemed to hinge on the idea that Phoenix is a wasteland during the summer daylight hours. A Rolling Stone profile of Phoenix's heat paints it as something of an apocalyptic dystopia. Sunshine assaults you, forcing you to seek cover. The air feels solid, a hazy, ozone-soaked curtain of heat, it reads. But our next guest has a slightly different perspective. Tom Zellner has seen this state for all that it is. He is a former Arizonan, and while he now lives in Los Angeles, he recently completed a through hike of the famous Arizona Trail. This goes from Mexico to Utah and spans the entire north-south length of the state. Yes, he survived the trek, and he's writing about it all and life in Arizona in a book of essays he's calling Rim to River, Journeys into the Heart of Arizona. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So I want to start with this first, get this out of the way. You live in L.A. now, which may have some of our listeners rolling their eyes at this conversation, but you are not an Arizona novice.
No. My family has lived in Arizona since before it was a state. I've had a long and profound relationship with it, and I even tried to get hired at the University of Arizona, but that didn't work. So here I am at my university in California.
Right. And I know you're in the midst of this book now, and we'll get into that soon. But I want to start with a little bit about your perspective on Arizona and on Phoenix. When you read headlines like some of the ones I just ran through there, what is your reaction?
Well, Phoenix has spent much of its adolescence as a city trying to defeat the desert.
trying to deny the idea that it even lives in the desert. Perhaps it takes something from the canals in that regard. One of the most instructive drives anyone can take in our city is to head north from downtown on Central all the way to Sunny Slope and look at that North Central neighborhood, which is founded on a vernacular of British pastoralism. You know, you look at the Murphy Bridal Trail, you look at those homes that are generously put out on these carpet-like lawns, attempting to recreate the English manor house. And in that sense, it's really interesting. I actually really like that drive, but it speaks to Phoenix's desire to push back, to deny reality, to not admit that it lives in the Upper Sonoran Desert.
So is that what is defining about this city to you, or do you think that that's shifting at this point? Do you think we're starting to see the light, so to speak?
Yes. Grady Gamage, one of the great intellectuals of Arizona urban development, said, where others see sprawl, we see our heritage. That pushing out to the margins into the desert is very much a part of the Arizona story. And that makes summer all the more interesting and challenging.
It does. So when you see people who are not from here or don't live here or never have come in and write about Phoenix, especially in those incredibly hot summer months, what do you think they're missing? Do you think that they don't understand that kind of Grady Gamage idea that you just outlined?
They're not wrong. But there are ways to think about summers differently. And this is an essential part of being an Arizonan. The relentless searing heat is for us, you know, not just an environmental fact of life, but part of the local narrative in the same way that snow is a part of Christmas fables, or that, you know, neon reflecting in rain puddles is a signature feature of noir fiction. You know, this is what we have. And instead of trying to defeat it through air conditioning, through these wonderful indoor spaces that we have to, in a sense, you know, muddle through the summer, there are ways to embrace the summer. One of them I might suggest is, if you can do this, if your job will allow you to do so, to embrace a kind of nocturnalism. This is what we see with, of course, Sonoran Desert wildlife, the great horned owl, the coyote, the bobcat, the gopher. They come out at night. They live nocturnal lives as opposed to diurnal lives.
That's interesting. And the city sort of feels different in the summer because of that, because more people tend to do that, get up or go out late at night, stay out late at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a friend of mine in Vermont describes her winter life like cave moss, you know, that sort of burrowing inside for the winter. And that's what we do as Phoenicians, is burrow inside for the summer. But there's another way to think about that too, which is this ought to be a civic requirement, I think, if you're going to live in Phoenix. And this is what I suggest: go outside and to let it pour down on you, not in some horrible urban, you know, asphalt heat island, but rather to go out to the desert. And I want to say to the K-Jazz listeners, do this safely by all means. make sure you know where you are at all times, and bring at least 2 liters of water, and have your GPS set and charge your phone. But by all means, go out to the desert and experience the heat as it hits down on the desert, pounds you like a sledgehammer. And this will do a couple of things. It's a reminder of the forces of nature that surround us and control us, that we try to deny and try to push back through air conditioning and technology, but it is the signature fact of life in Phoenix. And it will also, I think, provide a sense of awe for our ancestors, those who came before air conditioning, not just the first Latino and Anglo settlers, but also the ancient peoples who, in a sense, made their living from the summers and understood the summers as part of the cycle of life.
So you just did this through hike of the entire state on the Arizona Trail, and you're writing about it now. What did that teach you about this state and about some of maybe that history?
I developed a profound respect for water. I'll put that just as an elemental thing, where it's one thing to be thirsty and to be able to quench that, but it's another thing to be thirsty and not know that you're going to quench it, and to be 5 miles from the nearest spring with water running low and uncertain. And that's a way to think about Arizona in a, let's call it, an existential way. Secondly, this really doesn't have good words to describe it, but there's places in the Superstition Mountains when you're going along at night where you can see the massive glow of the valley on the western horizon. And to know it's there, but not to be able to see it directly. And it is something to know the valley from an immediate and daytime and commercial and personal and professional perspective, but it's kind of another thing to be at some remove from it and see its traces on the horizon.
Yeah. So last question for you, Tom. Arizona Phoenix is sort of always battling with this idea of identity and people being from somewhere else. Everyone, you know, comes here from elsewhere, and we're this city of sprawl and strip malls, et cetera. What do you see as the identity of this place when you describe it to people and say, this is where I'm from?
There's some amount of frustration in always wanting Arizona to be what it's not. And yes, we have a state whose culture politically, especially, is defined by those who come in from elsewhere and want to sort of remake what we have. But accepting that, you know, this is in fact Arizona, and that these newcomers are just as much citizens as we are. They have something to offer. And just as, you know, I do get frustrated with the same sprawl that Grady Gamage describes, part of coming to terms with Arizona, part of being at peace with it, is to accept that reality and in some way to celebrate it even.
All right. Tom Zellner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.